Okay, Erev Tov. Just a quick introduction. I don't know if everybody knows Rabbi Hatton. On behalf of Torah in Motion and Canadian friends of Pardes, I want to welcome you. I think this is the first time we're officially doing a program with, you know, Pardes, and I want to thank Dan Rabinowitz, who just like walked in from, you know, Pardes, and a pleasure, and hopefully the first of many programs we can do on a joint basis. Rabbi Hatton grew up actually in Toronto. He's been living in a lunch food for 18 years, where he runs the educators program at Pardes. He actually is a graduate architect at U of T, and then he switched careers. I know somebody else who did something like that, although not in architecture. And these are his two books. This is the Koran series, the Magid Koran series on Sefer Yoshua in English and passages. So I just, an author, an educator, a speaker, and it's a pleasure to have you. And without further ado, Bakasha.
Thank you so much. I should also point out I'm a graduate of Or Chaim.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is a special treat to be back in Or Chaim, standing on this side of the shtender. I wish my Rosh Yeshiva were here to see it. Okay, so I just want to take a moment or two talking about Pardes, if I may. For those that aren't familiar with Pardes, we're based in Yerushalayim. We're a learning institute that attracts Jews from every sort of background, a very diverse student body, diverse in terms of denomination, diverse in terms of age. We run many programs at Pardes. One that may be of particular interest to this crowd is the Executive Learning Seminar, which is a week of intensive learning and touring devoted to a topic. This year's topic is Ruth and Esther, and the program runs the first week of July. There is some literature on the table just in front of the snacks for people who want to learn more about our programs, and I'll ask people to sign in if you want to be on the mailing list. We don't send out a lot of junk mail, and we don't ask you for money, but if you're interested in, well, we do eventually, but if you're interested in any of our programs, and there's a whole list of offerings here, then please add your name to the list. Okay, so I'm going to hand that out, one on each side. Yes, most of the teaching, the vast majority of it, is in English.
We're already on the list. I didn't put it on.
Okay. Okay. All right, so we are going to get started. The topic tonight is Akedat Yishmael and Akedat Yitzchak, exploring the limits of trust. I know we all know about Akedat Yitzchak. I don't know how many of us know of Akedat Yishmael, except if you think perhaps I'm talking about the Islamic tradition that substitutes Ishmael for Yitzchak, but I'm not talking about that at all. I'm actually going to be talking about a text that you're familiar with, but perhaps not necessarily aware of the implications. In order to introduce the method that we're going to be using tonight, I want to throw out a word or two. And the word that I want to talk about briefly is intertextuality. Intertextuality is a fancy word that basically means, in the Tanakh, if we regard it as some sort of an integrated whole, if we understand the Tanakh to have some sort of internal consistency, so is it possible to say that one narrative in one part of the Tanakh may be related to another narrative in the other part of the Tanakh, and somehow they'll shed light on each other? Now, of course, we know that this is the case in terms of how the traditional commentaries operate, in terms of how the Midrash frames things. So I want to give you a classic example to illustrate what I'm talking about. If I were to ask a question on the story of Moshe and Yocheved, his mother, if you remember that moment at the beginning of Sefer Shmot, when male children are to be put to death, and Yocheved decides that she will save her child by placing him in a teva, in a basket, and placing him on the Yaor. And the question that's asked in the commentaries is, was this an act of desperation? Which is to say, she knew that she could not hide him any longer. It's an act of desperation. There was no other option. Or was this an act of faith, that she was entrusting the care of her child to God, and the destiny of that child to God? And it's difficult to answer that question based on the story. It's possible to interpret it in one direction. It's possible to interpret it in another direction. And the commentaries do. But if I were to say there perhaps is another story in the Torah which is connected to this one, although not at first glance, But when one considers the other story, immediately one understands that we're having some sort of an interpretation taking place. What do I mean by that? The word teva only occurs one other place in the Tanakh, which is in the story of Noah, right? And in the story of Noah, once we sort of make that connection, we're not talking about baskets and arks anymore. We're talking about tevot and digression, right? This is a good lesson in appreciating that when we read things in translation, we don't necessarily see the connections. Which is to say, if I read the story of Noah and I read about the ark and the rest of it, and I read the story of Yocheved and I read about the basket and the rest of it, I wouldn't have drawn any connection between the stories necessarily. But if I read about a teva in both stories, then it's clear that I'm dealing with a potential connection. And in fact, once I make that connection, then many other pieces of the story fall into place. In both stories, we have this decree of destruction. The Noah version, it's the flood, and in the Shemot version, it's Pharaoh. In both stories, the destructive element is water. And in both stories, the teva is that vehicle which will bring redemption to the world by taking care of its precious cargo, which is another way of saying we have an intertextual moment. Right? So I guess what I'm really trying to say is, if we ask ourselves, what is the earliest interpretation of the Torah or of the Tanakh, the answer is the Tanakh itself. It will interpret itself sometimes by offering us another story that sheds light on the first one. And when we talk about the Teva of Noah, we could ask another question, which is, what is a Teva at all? How is a Teva different from other sea-going vessels, of which we hear of in the Tanakh occasionally? We hear about a Sfina, which is a ship. We hear about a Sira. We hear about an Oniya, if you remember the story of Yonah. And yet Teva is an exceptional word that only occurs in those two stories. So what exactly is a Teva? Well, a Teva is exactly what it is when we use the term today, which is a chest or a box. In rabbinic literature, it's the Torah Ark, which is another level of interpretation. A Teva is some sort of a box-like craft. And as Ibn Ezra points out, it's a box-like craft that is not like a Sfina or an Oniya in the sense that it has no means of propulsion. There are no sails, there are no oars, there is no udder. Is that the word?
Rudder.
Rudder. Thank you. Yeah. Udder. No. There is no rudder. That wouldn't make sense. There's no udder either. But there's no rudder. That's the important point. Right? So there's no rudder, there's no sails, there's no oars. Right? That's a teva. It's just a box. A sfina has those other things. So what are the implications of that? I think they're clear. Noah cannot steer that craft. He cannot direct that craft. The safety of the denizens of the ark will depend upon only one thing, which is God's loving care and God's intervention. God will guide that craft to safe shores when the flood is over. Which is another way of saying, perhaps, to come back to the original question. When Yocheved places her child in the Teva, I would suggest the intertextual reading would indicate that it's not an act of desperation. It's an act of profound trust. She's entrusting the destiny of her child to God's intervention. But so that's an interpretation which emerges out of recognizing that we might be dealing with an intertextual moment, and that's my point. So we're going to try a similar exercise with the story of the Akedah. Here we don't have to look very far because I think the Torah itself arranges the narrative in such a way that we're asked to make a comparison without even trying, almost. So I want to begin with a famous Mishnah, and you have it on your sources in Masechet Avot. The Mishnah says, and you're all familiar with it, I'm sure, Asara nisiyonot nitnasa Avraham Avinu va'amad bichulam lehodia kama chibato shel Avraham Avinu. Abraham, our forefather, was tested with 10 trials, and he passed them all. It doesn't say he passed them with flying colors, by the way, but he passed them all. Lehodia kama chibato shel Avraham Avinu, in order to indicate how beloved is Avraham Avinu. Right, so Avraham's life, basically, according to the Mishnah here, is somehow marked by these 10 trials or 10 challenges. And Avraham succeeds in All of them. And of course, the Mishnah in this particular location does not specify what the 10 trials are. And there are various versions of what the 10 trials are. I'd say there's a rough correspondence among all of the versions. There are some things that everybody agrees upon and some things that are somewhat more controversial. So I want to read the Rambam with you. We're going to skip the Avot de Rabbi Natan for now. Go down to the Rambam at the bottom of page 1. Rambam goes through the 10 trials. And this is what he says. Harishon, Hagerut, Avraham's migration to the land. V'hu omro yit'ale lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimolatecha, Genesis chapter 12, Parshat lech lecha, get thee forth. This is the first of the trials, to leave behind everything and journey to the promised land. V'hasheni hara'av asher matza be'eretz kna'an, ka'asher hishtakia ba'aretz. The second is the famine that immediately confronts him when he gets there. Here's God offering a promise of a bright future. What does Abraham discover when he gets to the land? There's a harsh famine, and he immediately has to leave and go down to Egypt. Number three, Ashok Hamitzrim Oto Belikichat Sarah LaFaro. If you remember what happens when he gets to Egypt, so Pharaoh, at the advice of his ministers who take a liking to Sarah's attractiveness, Pharaoh seizes Sarah, and that's the third Nisayon. Harivii Hilachamo Ba'arba Amalachim. The fight against the four kings. The fifth, Lekacho Hagar, Kishino Ashmi Hohola Dami Sarah. Taking Hagar as a wife at Sarah's behest when he despaired of having children with Sarah. So to sort of have to take another wife was a challenge for him and Nisayon for him because it wasn't what he wanted. What he wanted was to have a child with Sarah, but that seemingly wasn't possible. The sixth was circumcision. That one I don't really have to explain. The seventh, Ashok Melech Gerar Oto Belikichat Sarah Gamken. If you remember, Avimelech also seizes Sarah. The eighth, Harchakat Hagar, driving out Hagar the first time, okay, when she flees and then she comes back. Hatishii Harchakat Beno Yishmael, driving out Yishmael, which was a very difficult challenge for Avraham. And the tenth, Akedat Yitzchak. Okay, so here we have the 10 trials according to the Rambam. There's probably a few famous ones that the Midrash mentions that Avraham does not mention. What guides the Rambam's enumeration of the 10 trials is he only will enumerate things that are written explicitly in the Torah text. So therefore, the whole interchange with Nimrod and Avraham being cast into the fiery furnace, which is a very, very famous Midrashic account, does not appear on the Rambam's list. Okay, so we could spend a moment or two talking about the number 10, because the number 10 comes up in all sorts of places in our tradition, such as... What?
I know.
Yeah, go ahead.
10 equals a minion.
10 for a minion, good. What else? Aseret HaDibrot, the 10, let's call them the 10 utterances. Good, yeah. 10 plagues. Any others?
Ten generations between.
Excellent. 10 generations from Abraham to Noah. Sorry, from Adam to Noah and Noah to Abraham. So the number 10, like many other numbers in the Hebrew Bible, is not just a number, but it's a motif. And the motif is some sort of a complete unit of something, whatever it is. Right? So if it's the 10 generations, because that's a particular block of time. And if it's the 10 utterances, it's because those are the foundation principles that contain the essence of everything else. And if it's a minyan, it's because without that magic number, you don't have a critical mass. 10 trials means this is some sort of a complete unit. Avraham achieves something over the course of these 10 challenges that he does not achieve having gone through 1 or 2 or 3 or 8. Now, it's not an accident that the first of the trials is Lech Lecha, and the last of the trials is also Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha el Eretz Hamoria, the Akedah, which is to say, basically, every significant event in the life of Avraham and Sarah is part of these 10 challenges. I mean, just go through it in your mind. everything that the Rambam mentioned pretty much are the significant events in Parshat Lech Lecha and Parshat Vayera. Vayera ends with the Akedah. Right after Parshat Vayera is the death of Sarah and Avraham winding down his own life. Before Parshat Lech Lecha, we're introduced to Avram and Sarai very briefly, but their story properly begins with Lech Lecha, which is another way of saying the 10 trials aren't just 10 trials. It's not simply the complete unit of everything that constitutes the journey of faith of these two, but it also happens to be a nice list of every significant event in their lives that the Torah mentions. For our purposes, I want us to note that the final two items on the list, one relates to the driving out of Yishmael, and the final one relates to the Akedah, which is an implication that perhaps we might be dealing with two events that are interrelated. It doesn't state so explicitly, but it's an implication. Perhaps there's a linkage between these two events, and that's what I'd like to explore. Okay? So let's look at the story. You have it in front of you on page 2. It begins in chapter 21 of Sefer Bereishit. That's the story of Yishmael and Hagar being driven out. Chapter 22 is the story of the Akedah. And in between is this, what I might term an interlude. The very end of chapter 1 is the story of the oath that Avraham concludes with Avimelech. And for that reason, that place was called Be'er Shava. So let's make our way through the story. I'm not going to read every single verse, but just to get a sense of the overall effect. If you remember, chapter 21 opens with the birth of Yitzchak. And what an incredibly happy occasion that was. In fact, when Yitzchak was born, Avraham called him Yitzchak, and Sarah related to that name in Pasuk Vav by saying, Vatomer Sarah Tzachok Asali Elohim, Kol Hashomea Yitzchakli. What a joyous moment it must have been. What a celebratory moment it must have been. How long did Sarah wait before she could have a child? How many years elapsed between... Avraham was... How old was Avraham when Yitzchak is born? 100. How old was Sarah when Yitzchak was born? 90, right? But how many years elapsed from the time that they entered the land until the time that Sarah had a child? V'Avram ben chamesh shanim v'shivim shana betzeito mecharan. Avraham was 75 when he left Haran. That's when the promise was first introduced. I will make you a great nation. You'll have children. You'll have a land. It wasn't fulfilled until 25 years later. So to live for 25 years under the shadow of that promise and to maintain one's trust in God and then to have that promise fulfilled must have been a moment of great joy, great vindication, great satisfaction. Kol hashomea yitzachakli. Sarah responds to that moment, the birth of Yitzchak, the name given to him, by suggesting that in fact, yes, it's appropriate that he received that name, because this is a moment of great joy. The child grows and is weaned, Pasuk Chet. Avraham makes, I guess, the first Kiddush in Jewish history when that happens, Mishteh Gadol, on the day that Yitzchak is weaned. And what does Sarah see? Pasuk Ted, Vateira Sarah et ben Hagar Hamitzrit, Asher Yalda LaAvraham Mitzachek. So she sees the son of Hagar the Egyptian. Well, we know who that is, but he's not mentioned by name. Why isn't he mentioned by name? Because there's a dissatisfaction with the behavior. He's not mentioned as Ishmael, he's mentioned as ben Hagar Hamitzrit. What is he doing? Mitzachek. It's obviously a play on words. He's also laughing, but he's not celebrating. It's a scornful laugh. It's perhaps a aggressive laugh. And by the way, this distinction between grammatically, what's called the pa'al form, the simple form, tzachak, versus the pl form, which is the intensive, tzichek, is very consistent. Whenever in the story of Avraham we want to speak about celebration and joy, we use the kal. We use the straightforward form, the pa'al form. Whenever we want to suggest something scornful or something aggressive, we use the intensive. Right? Remember Lot tried to convince his sons-in-law that they better escape because the end was near? And what is the text related to the sons-in-law? They looked at him like he was crazy. There's the intensive form. Yishmael is mitzachek. So he's not celebrating over the birth, over the weaning of Yitzchak. He's scorning it. He's making fun of it. The rabbis in the Midrash see something even more threatening, that perhaps he's even trying to somehow harm Yitzchak. I don't know if you have to go that far necessarily, but clearly the rabbis are concerned with his behavior because of the grammatical form that the verb takes. Sarah reacts immediately. Verse number Yud. Vatomer li Avraham, garesh ha'ama hazot ve'et bana, drive out this maidservant and her son. Ki lo yirash ben ha'ama hazot im bni im Yitzchak, he will not inherit with my son, with Yitzchak. And this contrast, or this competition, is going to characterize the rest of the story. So obviously there's a real fear here. After all, Yishmael is also the son of Avraham. What will that mean for the future when the time comes to decide the inheritance? Who will be regarded as the successor to Avraham? Will it be Yishmael? Will it be Yitzchak? Sarah casts the die. If Yishmael remains, it will be a danger for the future of Yitzchak as the legitimate heir of Avraham. And so Yishmael is driven out. But Avraham is not happy about it. Vayera hadavar, he was very upset. But God reassures him. What does God say? Whatever Sarah tells you, Shema bekola. I'm in Pasuk Yud Beit. Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei lecha zara, it is only through Yitzchak that your descendants will be secured. Your future will be secured. V'gamet ben ha'ama l'goy yasimenu, even the son of this maidservant, says God, I will make into a great nation because he's also your descendant, but that will not be the inheritor of your legacy. Yes?
It's interesting that you see Yishmael making fun. And the next thing is, drive out, then Sarah says, get rid of the mother as well. Not just get rid of the
Right.
Now, what does that tell us about how Sarah, I guess, viewed the mother's role in the house?
Yes. Recall that in Parshat Lech Lecha, there was also tension between Sarah and Hagar. Right? When Hagar became pregnant, Vatekal Givirta Be'eneha, she regarded her mistress, Sarah, as light in her eyes. Right? So there's clearly tension between the two. And I think that the tension actually is a direct function of who is going to be the heir to Avraham. So I think Sarah is quite clear that it's not just Yishmael that's the problem, but it's also Hagar.
She just said, I've had it with these guys.
So correct.
Get them both out.
Yes. Okay, yeah.
How did you translate
Yitzchak
by Yishmael?
I translated it as laughing with scorn. Mocking, okay, same kind
making
of idea.
Sport.
Making sport, it's something aggressive, it's something derisive,
teasing.
Right? If you remember also with Eshet Potiphar, right? What did she report about Yosef? Re'u hevi lanu ish ivri letzachek banu. Right, it's also the intensive, okay? Where? Yes. Yes, yes, the story of Yitzchak and Avimelech. Yeah. Right, that Avimelech saw V'hine Yitzchak mitzachek et Rivka ishto. Right, correct. Correct. Yeah, correct. So again, it's not just laughing, is the point, in a celebratory way. Okay, what happens next? Avraham wakes up in the morning, and I want us to pay attention to the phrases. Vayashkem Avraham babokir, Avraham wakes up in the morning, early. Avraham is always an early riser, by the way. It's a lesson for us all. Vayikach lechem v'chemat mayim, he takes bread, he takes a water skin, that's sort of, we would call it, bottled water, whatever, there you go. Vayiten el Hagar, he gives it to Hagar. Samal shichma, he places it upon her shoulder, along with the yeled, who turns out to be, how old is Yishmael at this time? 15?
Well, he was 13
when Yitzchak was born, right? And Yitzchak is already weaned, so, I don't know, teens, right? Mid-teens, something like that. I don't know why he's called Hayeled here. It's curious, okay? And he sends her forth, and she went and she wandered b'midbar be'er sheva in the wilderness of be'er sheva. Okay? I'll come back to that point. The water runs out. She casts the child under one of the bushes, verse 15. Verse 16, Vatelech, and she went. And she sat at a distance, the distance of a double bow shot. Ki amra al ereb motayalad, because she said, I do not want to see the death of the child. She sat opposite and she lifted up her voice and she cried. Verse 17. God heard the voice of the lad. An angel of God called to Hagar from heaven, min hashamayim, and said, Malach Hagar, what is up, Hagar? Al tiri'i, do not fear, because God has heard the call of the na'ar, of the lad, ba'asher husham, from where he is. Don't forget that she's not with him in the scene. Right? She's already deposited him under one of the bushes. She's distanced herself from him. A double bow shot of distance, because she did not want to see his death. The angel tells her, Pasuk Yutchet, arise and take the lad, place your hand and grasp him, ki legoy gadol asimenu, I will make him a great nation. God opened her eyes, she saw the well of water, she went and she filled up the water skin, and gave the lad to drink. God was with the na'ar, and he grew. He dwelt in the midbar, and he was an archer. Pasuk Kafalef concludes the account. Vayeshev b'midbar Paran. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took for him a wife from the land of Egypt. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question, which is, if you know, and if you don't know, you can look at chapter 22 to refresh your memories. What are the points of contact, the common elements between the story of Yishmael as related in this chapter and the events of the Akedah? The common elements might be similar phrasing. The common elements might be a similar scene. The common elements maybe have to do with the characters that are in each one of the respective stories. What comes to mind? Yes. Yes. Excellent. Okay. So, good. All of a sudden, right? If you remember, there is Hagar in despair. God opens her eyes, and what does she see? The well of water. Right? The angel calls to Avraham, and he lifts up his eyes, and what does he see? The ram. Okay? Caught in the thicket. What else? Yes, Dan.
Parent and child.
Parent and child. Okay? And by the way, parent and child in splendid isolation. No one else is around. It's Hagar and Yishmael and God. It's Avraham and it's Yitzchak and God. There is no one else in either one of those scenes except the parent and the child. What else? Yes?
Parent and child grow in the desert when they swim in the water.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to phrase it a little differently, because I'm going to suggest that Avraham never intended, nor did Hagar, that the water would run out. Right? There's a reason why the water runs out. He gives them supplies to complete the journey, whatever the journey is. But something happens, and instead the water runs out, and Yishmael's life is placed in danger. If I'm going to sort of paraphrase what you're saying a little bit, I would argue, the common element is, in both stories, we have a near-death experience. Yishmael is on the verge of death. Yitzchak is on the verge of death. And by the way, another common element is, these objects that are carried, that are born during the journey. So for Yishmael, for Hagar, it's like you said, it's the bread, it's the water, it's these things that are placed, right? Samal Shichma, placed on her shoulder. And what is it in the Akedah version of the story? What does Avraham take? The wood, the fire, the ma'achelet, the knife. And the firewood, by the way, is placed upon Yitzchak. He carries that, right? So we have objects that are borne by the protagonists, right? We have a near-death experience which unfolds, in one case unexpectedly, in one case unexpectedly, and we have this parent-child in splendid isolation from everyone else. Yeah?
Is this Yitzchak also referred to as Yada in the story of Rebekah?
Kachnat binchat yechidcha. No. Yes, and I think, you know, you have to watch those turns of phrase very carefully, because very often they indicate the perspective of the character in the scene. Which is to say, for Avraham, it's a yeled. How am I supposed to let my child go? Objectively, it's a na'ar, which is how he's related to, right? By the narrator, quote unquote. When Hagar deposits him under one of the bushes, he's a yeled, because that's her child. Doesn't matter that he's a strapping teenager, that's her child, right? So very often how we describe a person in a biblical moment is a direct function of the perspective of someone else who is looking into the scene. Yes?
I'm just curious about also perceived differences.
Not yet. Not yet. I need a few more similarities first. We'll get to the differences. Yes?
Can we say that they were both open-ended journeys? Meaning there was no stated mission, there was no, we need to go out here and do this.
Okay.
We're just going out.
Good. We could say that there's a certain amount of ambiguity as the journey begins, right? So Avraham doesn't know where he's going. Oh, I'll tell you where you go, right? You're going to Eretz HaMoriah. Right, to one of those hilltops, Achad Heharim Asher Omar Elecha. I'll tell you, but not yet. So when the journey commences, they don't know where they're going, really. And one gets the sense, perhaps, in the Yishmael Hagar version of the story, that there's a similar ambiguity. We're not told where they're going. And wherever they were supposed to go, they don't make it. So there must have been some sort of confusion, quote unquote, about the destination. Okay, yeah. Good. An angel intervenes at the last moment. Right? As each one of the children is on the cusp of death, an angel intervenes, calls from the heavens, and communicates a very similar message. What's the message? Everything's going to be okay. This child will be the progenitor of a great nation. Right? So the ends of the stories are quite similar. Along the same lines, by the way, how does each one of those stories begin insofar as Avraham is concerned? Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. It's the exact same phrase. Okay, now like I said, it's true Avraham is an early riser because he gets up early one more time in the story, right? When it's time to check on the fate of Sodom and Amorah and the rest of it, right? But nevertheless, the fact that the phrase is used in both of these stories back to back indicates, well, his enthusiasm, number one, and number two, that there's a connection here. Yeah.
You made the point that both involve a parent.
Yes.
But in both situations, the child never sees the parent who wasn't with them again.
Be Sarah. Careful about that one. Oh, wait, say that again?
Yitzchak never sees Sarah again.
Yeah, be
Does
careful with that one.
See Abraham?
I don't know. They're both are unclear. I don't know. I mean, I know they're, you know, depending on how we interpret the framing of Sarah's death, it's possible that Yitzchak doesn't see her. It's possible. But it's more complicated than that. Right? It only works if Sarah's death is, as the Midrash suggests, in the immediate aftermath of the Akedah. Right? But that's not necessarily the case. That's going to introduce a whole other question about the age of Yitzchak at the Akedah. Well, do we? Well, that's the Midrash. But that is directly related to the age of Sarah at her death, and that's how we do the math. We know that Sarah's 127. We know that she's 90 when he's born. Ergo, Yitzchak is 37 at the Akedah. But that's not clear from the Akedah itself. And obviously it changes the nature of the whole story if Yitzchak is a grown man or if he's a child. Right? Okay. One other... Yeah, go ahead.
Conduct by Abraham that is not understandable.
Say again?
Conduct by Abraham that is not understandable.
Okay, good. In both cases... Yeah, it looks like he's going to sort of, you know, throw his child to, you know, the cruel fates, if you want to call it that, in both situations at first glance. Okay, good, yes.
Well, I question that. I would suggest, and I've heard it from others, it's not my own idea, that Abraham, in the case of Ishmael, did not throw to him. He said to Agar, go to point B.
Yes.
Agar started wandering around in the desert.
The central bus station in Beersheba. That was the destination. Right?
She never made it.
She never made it.
She was in the desert wandering around.
Okay. It could be. Could be. Either or.
She was in the desert. She was wandering
yes.
around.
I mean, that would certainly exonerate Avraham from an otherwise...
She gave him the food and the water.
Yes.
State, go to the Beersheba.
It would exonerate him from an otherwise difficult charge, for sure. Okay. One more comparison, I would say. Yeah, go ahead.
Response to what Moshe said. I mean, in both cases, he was ambivalent in the case of Ishmael, but Hashem said, listen to your wife and do it. I mean, his behavior may be difficult, but he's
divinely ordained. Yes. Good point.
Would you listen to Hashem?
We'll get to that.
Would you listen to Hashem?
I'll tell you a funny story. My kid asked me once, many years ago, when he was young and I was young, he said, so tell me, if God would tell you to sacrifice me, would you do it?
Whoa.
Yeah, well, I said the wrong thing, I'll tell you that. What I should have said was, God would never ask me to do such a thing. How could God ask me? I'll get back to that point a little later.
Okay? Other cases, particularly Sodom, he did argue.
Yes, so why doesn't he argue here?
Yeah,
that's a classic question. Okay, so one other comparison I want to point out before we get to some of the differences. Both stories end the same. How does Ishmael's story end? Ishmael's story ended with the report that his mother took him a wife from the land of Egypt. Verse 21. Vayeshev b'midbar paran, he dwelt in midbar paran, v'tikachlo imo isha me'eretz Mitzrayim. How does the story of the Akedah end? With a report of, and this is, I think, an excellent illustration of how we are sometimes selective in terms of where we end a story, and it can be detrimental to how we interpret it, because interpreting a story is also a function of where you decide the story ended. What's reported in the aftermath of the Akedah? After these things, he was told to Abraham, saying, Milcah has also given birth to your brother Nahor. And we have a whole list of these unpronounceable children. But that's not the point. The point is one of them, which is Bituel. Bituel begats Rivkah. And as we're going to find out later in the story, that's going to become Yitzchak's wife. Which is another way of saying the Akedah story also ends with... a marriage through implication. Right? The reader is being alerted to the fact, just as Ishmael's story ended with a report of his marriage to a woman from the land of Egypt, Rivka's birth is reported here because very, very shortly, she's going to become Yitzchak's wife. Which is another way of saying, for both of them, the near-death moment concludes optimistically, positively, with a promise of a future. They'll survive. And not only will they survive, but they will transmit on to the next generation. Ishmael will become a nation, and Yitzchak will become a nation. So if you do the math, I would suggest that in fact we have 10, at least, similar features between both of the stories. And these are they. They're both precipitated by a divine call. They both begin with Abraham rising early in the morning. They both involve items that are carried for the journey. In both situations, the parent and the child are alone. In both situations, the child experiences a near-death moment. In both situations, an angel will react. In both situations, there will be a divine intervention which saves the child from death. In both situations, that will be coupled with the promise of nationhood. In both situations, the parent will then see some sort of a restorative object and fetch it, the water from the well, the ram in the place of Yitzchak. And in both situations, a marriage will be reported that will take place through the agency of that very parent that was present at the near-death experience. Okay, which is a short way of saying it's difficult not to see these two stories as being interrelated. And in that sense, I think it's fair to talk about Akedat Yishmael. Akedat Yishmael is the story of Yishmael's brush with death, which resembles the story that follows, the story of his half-brother Yitzchak and his brush with death. Now, of course, there's an interlude between the two. And the interlude between the two is a fascinating study in itself. That's the end of chapter 21. At that time, Abimelech and Pichol, his chief of staff, approached Abraham, and what did they say? We see that God is with you. We want to conclude a covenant between me, my child, my grandchild, and you. Let's conclude a covenant, a treaty of non-aggression. What does Abraham say? I will swear that oath. But wait a second here. What about the wells of water that your servants have been stealing? What does Avimelech say? Verse 26 of chapter 22. Vayomer Abimelech, Lo yadati mi asat hadavar hazeh. I don't know who did it. You never told me. I never heard about it before today. That's like too many excuses, seemingly. But anyways, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Oh, if only I would have known. I would never have allowed my servants to steal your wells. And so they make a covenant. And the covenant revolves around the seven sheep, which is also, Shiv'ah, is also the root of the word Shivu'ah, which means oath. And that's an intentional play on words. They conclude an oath over the seven sheep, and they call that place Be'er Sheva until this very day. Okay? That's the interlude between the stories. So if I were to ask you, let's examine this little piece in isolation for one moment. What would you say is the central idea insofar as the oath between Abraham and Avimelech is concerned? What is that little interlude trying to indicate? What does it want to say? In isolation, what is it telling us? Not connected to the Akedah and on either end, the Akedah of Ishmael or the Akedah of Yitzchak. What's that little piece about? In one word. politics, yes, okay. Yes, it is about politics. But let me ask a different question. On what do those politics depend? What's the essence of the oath?
Trust.
No trust, no oath. If I can't depend on you, then how can we have a covenant between us? How can we possibly have an agreement? Well, we all know that story, right? If you can't depend on whoever it is that you're trying to conclude a covenant with, then what's it worth? Nothing. That's a story about trust. And therefore, Abraham says, before we get to any covenants, let's talk about the wells that were stolen. And Avimelech says, yeah, let's. I'm so sorry, if only I would have known. Once we resolve that issue, which is to say, I guess we'd call it today, the confidence-building measures, then we're ready to conclude an agreement. Okay? Now, this is an agreement that looks towards the future. What does it say? This is an agreement, says Avimelech, between who? Me and my child and my grandchild after me. This is long term. So I want us now to reflect on what's going through Avraham's mind at precisely that moment when Avimelech says, this is an agreement between me and my son and my grandson after me. What is Avraham thinking? What? Well, what's just happened in chapter 21? Who was driven out in chapter 21? Who's driven out? Yishmael was driven out. Hagar was driven out. They're gone. Who's left? Yitzchak is left. What is Avraham thinking to himself when he concludes that oath? This is for Yitzchak and for Yitzchak's children. Which is another way of saying, in Avraham's mind, maybe for the first time, he's capable of imagining a future that's going to extend beyond him. And by the way, there's nothing else left. Lot is long gone. Yishmael has been driven out. All of the hopes of the future rest upon Yitzchak. And Avraham concludes that oath. Because after all, God promised, didn't he? Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei lecha zara. Through Yitzchak you will have descendants. Through Yitzchak you will have a future. I guess what I want to suggest is, if we thought that the Akedah was an insurmountable challenge of faith, when we read chapter 22, now we have to bump it up a few orders of magnitude. It's not just an act of tremendous trust and faith in isolation. But when we put it in context, we appreciate what Avraham must have been thinking. Here I am, I've just concluded a treaty with Avimelech that looks towards the future. Because for the first time in 25 years, since this whole crazy adventure began, I can imagine that I have a future. Because I have a descendant called Yitzchak. And what a celebration that was. What a moment of joy that was to see the fulfillment of the divine promise. I can make that oath. For the future. And then like a thunderbolt, chapter 22. Take your son. Take your only son. Take the son whom you love. Velech lecha. Play on words. Embark on that journey. Says Avraham, yeah, I've heard that one before. That's how the whole story started. With that promise of descendants and a future and a nation and a land. And now what are you asking me to do? What are you asking me to do, God? Surrender everything. Everything that you promised. Everything that I believed in. Everything that was the basis of our relationship is now cast into jeopardy. If that were not enough, there's another dimension to the story. It's called the chapter 18 dimension. And it comes back to somebody's question on the side. Your question. When Sodom and Amorah are in danger of destruction, what does Avraham do? He pleads on their behalf. What's the basis of his plea? On what basis does he have the audacity to argue on behalf of Sodom and Amorah? Hashofet chol haaretz lo ya'aseh mishpat. Can the God of justice of all the earth not do justice? And the answer obviously is no. Of course the God of justice has to do justice. I want us to appreciate what's at stake in the story. It's not simply Avraham's future. It's not simply the child that they have prayed for 25 years. It's not just Sarah's broken heart. It's God's reputation. Everything that Avraham has propagated for his whole life about God as the God of justice, God as the God of morality, God as the God of goodness. Remember what God said when he wondered, should I reveal to Avraham what I'm planning to do? What did God say? I have to reveal it to him because I know that Avraham will command his children after him. Vishamru derech Hashem la'asot tzedaka u'mishpat. That's the essence of what God stands for. Tzedaka and mishpat. Righteousness and justice. To kill your child is neither right nor just. And to do so flies in the face of everything that God promised, looking towards the future. That's what's at stake in the Akedah. So my question is, what can the story of Akedat Yishmael shed on the issue, the central issue of Akedat Yitzchak, which is the issue of trust, trust in God? All right, so let's talk about some of the differences between the two stories. You had one, yeah. Yes.
Is Agar found?
Yes.
So is that the same Be'er Mayim, or are we talking about when she was in the wilderness of Beersheba and God pointed out the Be'er Mayim, that was the same Be'er Mayim that he subsequently brings to the attention of Elimelech as the basis of a treaty?
Literarily it is.
Right.
In reality, is it? I don't know. It's an interesting point. Okay, so I think that's really the question. In other words, whether or not it's the same Be'er is really not the question. The question is, the Torah sort of uses similar language to describe it. Right, so what are the implications of that? And I would argue, yes, there's some sort of a conscious attempt to connect whatever happened to Yishmael with whatever is happening between Avraham and Avimelech. Okay? So I'm going to argue, yes, you're precisely right. But we have to investigate it a little bit further in order to appreciate what the significance might be. Okay?
Right, I'll
yeah.
Wait for you to let me know.
Remind me if I don't.
Okay. But I guess the difference that sort of strikes me, I mean, there's many differences, but I've never understood why in the story of the Akedah Yitzchak, he goes to Moria, Avraham goes to Moria, and he brings with him Na'arim.
Right.
To carry things, to make things easier, to get there. God
yes.
Maybe. But in the story of Hagar, he sends Hagar. She doesn't have a GPS. He just sends Hagar to the desert. It would have been so easy to send those Ne'arim or the same Ne'arim to guide her.
Yes.
To whatever destination she was supposed to get to.
Yes. Okay, so that's a difference.
Right.
Now, it could be circumstantial evidence for the argument that The intention was for Hagar to go somewhere relatively nearby. I.e., you don't need the chamor with all of the provisions if you're just going on a short journey, or what should have been a short journey.
But it's a desert. There's no lights.
No, she's a Bedouin, though. I mean, it's not like, you know, us urban dwellers that...
She was an Egyptian princess.
Midrashically, right? But I'm saying, you know, in actuality, she probably has familiarity with the landscape to some degree. No, I'm not convinced. I'm saying I recognize that there's a difference there. I don't know if it's a difference which is faithful. Let's put it that way. But yes, there is a difference, for sure.
It turns out to be faithful.
Yes. I think one could say, in the Avraham Akedah version of the story, there's a divergence that happens. I.e., the Ne'arim and the Chamor accompany Avraham and Yitzchak to a point, and then they have to continue the journey alone. Shvulachem poim hachamor, right? There's a point by which, after which they may not go. Avraham and Yitzchak have to be alone. Okay. Okay. Yes. Go ahead.
So, in the story of Yitzchak, Avraham is directly involved in the near death experience.
Yes.
With Yishmael, he's once removed.
Yes.
From being directly involved.
As is Hagar. Right? In other words, the parent in both stories are the parents, right? There's a difference between how involved they are in the near-death experience. In the Yitzchak version of the story, Avraham is going to be the vehicle for the near-death experience, right? And in the Yishmael story, Yishmael and Hagar, certainly Avraham and Yishmael, are very, very far from each other. Good. What else? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Good. Good. Excellent. Right. What's this? What's the word that's used to describe Avraham and Yitzchak in each
yachdav?
Each critical moment in the journey has a yachdav. As they embark, yachdav. As Yitzchak questions, "Ayei haseh le'ola?" Not to worry. God will find the seh le'ola b'ni. And you know Rashi's ominous reading, Le'ola b'ni, you're going to be the burnt offering. Vayelchu shnehem yachtav, and nevertheless they go yachtav. At the end of the story, Vayakumu vayelchu yachtav, they arose and they went together to Be'er Sheva. There's a togetherness that characterizes the Akedah of Yitzchak's story every step of the way. And we never see that togetherness in the Hagar Yishmael story. They're distant. They're far away. She distances herself from him. Yeah.
I find that one major point is the fact before he sends Yishmael and Hagar, Hashem assures him that the ending will be okay. That,
yes.
That Yishmael will survive and become a good nation.
Good.
I mean, the total converse is Hashem is saying he's not telling him the end.
All bets are off. Right. Excellent. Good. So God doesn't indicate to Avraham at the beginning of the Akedah journey what the outcome is. Well, he does, sort of. It's not going to be pretty, is really what God indicates. Right?
It makes his behavior more inexplicable.
Good. Okay. Good.
Where does the story start? Because if the story starts with the promise that you're going to be a great nation, then Avraham knew that he wasn't going to be.
Interesting. So now we're sort of wondering, what does Avraham think when the Akedah journey commences? Right? Which version of God's word should he be hanging his future on? The promise with which his story began, or the command to sacrifice Yitzchak now? Good. Okay, yes.
This is one of the troubles.
Mm-hmm.
The Torah then says this distressed Abraham greatly.
Yes.
An emotional reaction.
Yes.
That he was distressed, and then God says, "Listen to your wife." When he goes to Moriah with the Na'arim and Yitzchak, the son he loves, there's no distress right through to the point of contact.
Yes. Good.
And
At least not one that we hear.
Not one that's in the text.
Correct. Very good points, right? So in the Ishmael version of the story, it's clear that Abraham is unhappy. He feels that this is unacceptable. Vayera hadavar ma'od b'nei Avraham aladot b'no. And in the Akedah, utter and complete silence.
What wasn't God's idea with Hagar and Ishmael?
Well, it was to some degree. God confirmed it. Whatever Sarah tells you, do it.
Right? But God wasn't the initiator.
Okay. I hear that, but I don't know if Abraham would have done it if God would not have told him to do it. Go through with it. Yeah.
There's one difference, although I have no idea what the significance of it is, that Yitzchak speaks, if only briefly, whereas Ishmael doesn't say anything.
Good. Yitzchak speaks, and he asks really the burning question, no pun intended, right? Which is, where is that lamb for the offering? Right? Whereas Ishmael doesn't say anything.
Ishmael cries. He's got no.
Okay. Crying. In the Akedah version of the story, no tears are shed. No cries are heard. Not Abraham's cries and not Yitzchak's cries. In the Hagar Ishmael version of the story, everyone's crying. She sits opposite, she cries. The angel hears, Kol hana'ar ba'asher husham. He must have been crying too. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say the Ishmael story is much more emotive. There's a lot of emotion.
Yes.
In it, in a way that the story of Yitzchak and Akedah is very, almost cold.
Good. Okay. So, I don't know if it's possible to reduce all of these differences to one idea, but I'm going to try. Okay. What I'm going to suggest is the following. The essence of Akedat Ishmael is that it is a story in which the protagonists do not have certainty about the destination. And I mean that geographically, and I mean that existentially. Which is to say, when Hagar and Ishmael embark on the journey into the wilderness, they do not know where they are going. Which is why they wander aimlessly. There's an aimlessness associated with them. There's a lack of focus. There's a lack of certainty. And what that translates into, ultimately, is a lack of trust as well. So at the moment of crisis, as Ishmael is about to expire, Hagar's reaction is not to take initiative, but to desperately break down and cry. She doesn't know what to do, because that's the nature of the story. It's a story in which the protagonists do not know what to do. They don't know how it's going to end. They don't know where they're going. They can't focus their thoughts on their trust in God. God will intervene, but it's like a miracle. In the Akedat Yitzchak story, the destination for which Avraham and Yitzchak embark on the journey remains in their sight every step of the way, even though they don't know where it is. They never lose sight of the destination. They are focused on the goal, as grisly as it is. They will never get lost along the way. There will not be a moment of desperation when they break down and cry, because that confusion and that ambiguity and that lack of focus and that wandering existentially speaks about a lack of trust in the certainty of God. And if it's one thing that Avraham and Yitzchak have, it is certainty in their trust in God. What I mean by that is the following. I'm convinced that Avraham is convinced that God will not allow him to kill his child. And I have to believe that for two reasons at least. If God allows Abraham to kill Yitzchak, then that cancels out everything that God promised from the beginning of the story. One second. That's on the personal level. On the theological level, if God allows Abraham to kill his child, then that cancels out everything that Abraham has ever taught about the truth of God. God's justice, God's righteousness, God's concern with morality, all of it is wiped out. Which is another way of saying Abraham's trust in God is such so that he knows that God will not allow him to go through with the Akedah. So you'll say, well, then what's the challenge? It's still a challenge, believe me. Because there's always that uncertainty until the final moment. It's not an accident that God only calls it off as Abraham stretches out his hand and lifts the knife. And by the way, that's a slow motion moment. Right? Vayishlach Avraham et yado vayikach et ha-ma'achelet lishchot et b'no. It's like this. Right? That's what the text is describing. And it's only when the knife is at the final, the point of no return, that God calls it off. I guess what I'm really saying is, the trust that Abraham has in God is mirrored by the trust that Yitzchak has in him. What do I mean by that? What is Yitzchak thinking when he asks that question? Yeah, Dad, we got the wood, we got the fire, we got the knife. Where the heck is the lamb? I mean, by the way, just to sort of put it in perspective, you don't like go into the wilderness and find a lamb all of a sudden. It's sort of depending on a lot of things if you think you're going to find a lamb in the middle of Eretz Moriah. Right? So what is Yitzchak thinking when Abraham answers, not to worry, dear child. God will provide the lamb. What is Yitzchak thinking? I'll tell you what he's thinking. I'm the lamb. Now you might say, well, why doesn't he run? Why doesn't he make a break for it? Ibn Ezra has this crazy interpretation. He says it must be the case that Yitzchak is old enough to carry the wood, but young enough not to be able to escape. Because he wanted to escape desperately. I would say no, he didn't want to escape. Why didn't he want to? Because he trusted his father. The bond between those two is so overwhelmingly powerful that if Abraham says, it's going to be okay, my child, Yitzchak will believe him. So strong is the trust and the love. Vayelchu shnehem yachdav. Before that revelation and after it. And when they descend from the mountain, I know there's this whole psychoanalysis routine about Yitzchak suffering, what do they call it? Post-traumatic stress disorder, right? And he never is reconciled to his father. I think that's a complete misreading of the story. At the end of the story, they are so close, intensely close. It just says, Vayakumu Vayelchu Yachdav. They've become one person. Because it's a story about trust. It's a story about a child trusting his parent implicitly and explicitly and everything in between. And the analogy is, just like Yitzchak trusts his father, Abraham trusts his father, which is to say God. And all of that is lacking in the Hagar Ishmael version. There is no trust. There is no yachdav. There is no direction. There is no focus. And the story breaks down. She cries. He cries. Were it not for divine intervention, it would have been the end. In other words, Akedat Yitzchak is the version of the story that indicates to us why it is that the legacy of Abraham will not be traced through Yishmael and Hagar, but rather through Sarah and Yitzchak, because he's the child that trusts, and you're the father that trusts. And Hagar and Yishmael are neither. And by the way, I'm not saying I would have reacted any differently than Hagar and Yishmael. What I am saying is, Avraham and Yitzchak in that moment teach us the most profound lesson of trust. I know, says Avraham, deep, deep down, maybe it's subconscious, maybe it's not, that at the end of the day, I cannot go through with this. Because that would call into question everything that you, God, stand for. And everything that I, Avraham, stand for. And everything that Yitzchak stands for as well. I want to share sort of a scene which I think captures this. And it's an unnerving scene, to be perfectly honest. The good news is that the Akedah ends positively. But as we all know, in Jewish history, that was often not the case. The Akedah was carried out with that same trust. There is a report about at the Nuremberg trials, and I can't remember the exact individual who it was referring to, but one of the members of one of the Einsatzgruppen. The Einsatzgruppen were these mobile killing squads that followed the German army into Russia and into the Ukraine before the death camps were in full swing. And they would round up the Jews, as you know, and gather them in a ravine or whatever it was, and then shoot them all. It was a massacre. And one of the Einsatzgruppen leaders records the following. You can find it online. I can't remember exactly which group it was and who the individual was. He says, you know, there were the Jews, and, you know, they would all be lined up, waiting to be executed. And I remember he says that there was a mother holding her child. And the child looked at the mother very knowingly. And they exchanged some sort of a conversation between them. And then she pointed heavenwards, and they embraced, and then they were shot to death. And I think that's what this moment is about. That Yitzchak has trust in his father in spite of everything. And it really is in spite of everything. Because that's the essential message of the story. You want to understand what trust in God is really about? You don't have to look so far. Just think of your own child and the trust that they have in you. That's what we're aiming for when we talk about trust in God. And that's ultimately the difference between Akedat Yishmael and Akedat Yitzchak. And by the way, I know we have to end. I want to suggest one more word, and that's it. The interlude of Avimelech and Avraham now makes perfect sense. Right? What does Avimelech say? We're going to have a wonderful little covenant between me and my son and my grandson. And, obviously, you, Avraham, and your son Yitzchak, and your grandson as well. And what does Avraham say? Yeah, but what about those whelps? And Avimelech says, oh, I didn't know anything about it. Right? And then they'll conclude a covenant, ostensibly forever. What happens in Parshat Chayei Sarah? Avimelech drives out Yitzchak. Lech mi'imanu. And what does Yitzchak discover to his horror? All the wells that had been dug by Avraham's servants, Bimei Avraham Aviv, what happened to those wells? Sitmum pelishtim vayimal'u mafar. So much for peace treaties. The covenant between human beings can never be forever. Only the covenant between God and man can be forever. Because human beings are not dependable. Human beings are fickle. That's the nature of it. Treaty today and no treaty tomorrow. But the covenant between God and Avraham, that's absolutely dependable. There can be no question about that. So on the heels of the treaty between Avimelech and Avraham, which ultimately doesn't last very long, comes the Akedah. A questioning of the fundamental agreement between Avraham and God. What emerges in the end? Guess what, Avraham? You can depend on me. I won't ask you to sacrifice your son. And with that, the story concludes. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Nobody. Thank you. We can do it in
a huh?
Privately, I guess.
Privately? Okay. Yeah, I got to let you go. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're very enjoyable.